Session number 6125, reel 4.
Mr. Hale, tape 4.
Quite a large number of the dancers were arranged to raise funds for Spitfires, a name that very much caught the imagination. Our training was stepped up on the mainland, in particular, because the territory was all new to my particular battalion, and we had to find our way around the ground, and we had to climb everything that was climbable and everything that was not climbable. Tam O Shan, which is the largest peak out in Hong Kong, was scaled a good many, many times. We used mules extensively, which incidentally I never saw one when war broke out. Probably they didn't have time to get the things out of the stables or away from their lines where they keep them, because things move so rapidly when the war actually did hit the colony. But quite a lot of our training was done with the mules. As a result of the battalion being on the borders of the Shum Chun River, we went down very rapidly with malaria. I think out of the battalion, about 600 or 700 strong, perhaps 400 or 500 had either in hospital, been in hospital, or suffering from some form of malaria or the shakes. As a result, when the war came, the men were very, very unfit, despite the training that had been stepped up. You not only had their physical unfitness, you had the mental feeling that that you were not really a part of what the UK was fighting for. In fact, I would think morale was pretty low, really, as far as the war was concerned. I think everyone was quite happy to carry on with a round of enjoyment, but we were told nothing to worry about. Our equipment was better, and despite what was going on in Shanghai and that was going on in the UK, Hong Kong seemed very remote. The hotels were still flourishing. Although we were on the border, I was still playing at quite a number of dances. The battalion was spread in company and platoon strength around the new territories. And on Sundays, I used to be driven around in a 1,500-weight truck with a piano on it, and the padre used to accompany me from section to section to play a few hymns at his church services. In fact, I was doing that on the Sunday before the Japanese hit us on the Monday. I was playing quite a bit of tennis down at Civil Service Club with members of the Hong Kong government. I was hoping to leave the army and take up a position in the government. I'd been offered the chance of a commission in 1939, but due to the good life that I was having in Hong Kong, in fact, I was very friendly with the young lady to whom I was subsequently engaged. I didn't want to leave the colony. One or two members of the band did leave. Sergeant Green, he left, went to Singapore, and as did Mickey North, he went. Green finished up a major, and Mickey North, I believe he became a lieutenant colonel. But the whirl of good life still went on in Hong Kong. The girl I was engaged to be married to worked at command headquarters. She had been evacuated with her mother and two sisters to Australia when the general evacuation of all civilian and married quarters personnel were sent from the colony.
When was that?
That would be in about early on the war. It would be 39-40. Mm. They were all sent from the colony, all the women and the children. apart from those retained on essential services. As I say, my young lady, her two sisters and her mother, they were evacuated, and en route to Australia, they called in at the Philippines to receive a telegram from the colony that their father, who was working in the Hong Kong dockyard, which now, naval dockyard, which now incidentally ceases to exist, was very ill, and she was recalled, or the family was recalled, only too late, their father had died. So there was no further berths available for shipment to Australia, so they remained in the colony. And my girl worked at garrison headquarters as a shorthand typist. And gave me the information that our battalion was due for a move to the Middle East. And I, wanting to remain in the colony, applied for a commission, and I went before a board of officers and was accepted, and was standing by to go to Singapore with one other person from the unit. But that never obtained, because the war came before we could get to Singapore. And I was actually playing tennis on the Sunday afternoon when the military police came over to us there and asked if there were any service personnel playing, and if there were, we were to return immediately to our units, as they were fearful that some action was going to be taken
against
the colony.
Was that the first you heard?
I heard that anything was likely to take place, anything that was close as that. We never really believed it would happen. There was nothing to say it would. I mean, the fact that we were under canvas and training, well, we'd been under canvas before. Two Canadian units came into us, but they were untrained. They came into us in November. The Winnipeg Grenadiers and the Royal Rifles of Canada, they arrived, and they arrived with no equipment whatsoever. The equipment went down by their ship, I think it was called the Prince Rupert. They carried on down to Australia. So they had to share in what equipment we had. Some of them had never fired or even handled a rifle, an ordinary service rifle. In one of the units, I'm not sure whether it was the Rifles of Canada or the Winnipeg Grenadiers, but one of the battalions had seen service in the West Indies, but the others were just scraped up off the highways and the byways. So I understand it, and sent out to Hong Kong just as a gesture. I don't know if it was a gesture as what. I read so clearly, of course, it was for political reasons as far as the Canada was concerned. They wanted to get in on war theatre, war footing. And I suppose they took the place of the two battalions of Kamayans who were taken away from us.
Were you aware of the activities of the Hong Kong Volunteer Defence Force?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't aware of them. I was aware of them more when the fighting took place. Their record and their standing is very high through the war, and what their natural bearing and that as prisoners of war in Hong Kong was very high. When one considers that so many of them were elderly, some of them had never been servicemen, but they had done quite a bit of training. Quite a number of the civilians in Hong Kong became members of the Hong Kong Police Force. Quite a number of them had a rank of inspector or sub-inspector. In fact, my particular pal was an inspector on the Hong Kong Police Force Reserve, I think his station was down in Wan Chai area. But when the war came, he wasn't able to take up his duties in the police force. He was too occupied with his duties on the water board.
Had you done any special exercises concerning defending Hong Kong?
Well, of course, as I said earlier, my battalion was pushed out onto the new territories. We had to learn things anew. The Canadian regiment battalion was pushed into the Shamshi Po barracks, which the Middlesex formerly held. The Middlesex were taken out of Shamshi Po and put in Murray barracks. We were put up on the front here, and the Canadian battalions were put in Shamshi Po. I don't know where the other battalion went to. We had a company stationed up at the peak in Hong Kong, a company of about 150 men. There was a permanent station up the higher ground in Hong Kong. We were, even when we were in Hong Kong, we were scattered a bit. But we had one lot over on the mainland, one lot up at the peak, and one unit in Murray Barracks. But we did quite a bit of training up here on Down Dales. We were supposed to occupy the Shing Moon Redoubt. That was supposed to be a strong defensive line. But we shoved in roll after roll of barbed wire for weeks, I suppose, before the crunch came. We slung in lots of barbed wire. And generally went out of a way to make it difficult for anything to come through the border. But, of course, all the culverts and the roads were all mined. But the biggest problem, of course, in Hong Kong was water. The catchment areas, considering the population of Hong Kong in those days, was very, very small. And of course, the Japanese were wide awake enough to know that all they had to do was to simply sit back and just knock out the waterworks. And that would do all that was necessary without any actual fighting, really. And I believe that we had a large infiltration of spies, because the average person, a European, he had great difficulty in telling the difference between a Japanese and a Chinese. And then you've got to remember there were Chinese who were who favoured the Japanese cause anyhow, the Wang Qingwei Chinese, similar as Nehru and his Free India a lot. There was also the Chinese Wang Qingwei outfit.
Were they very common in Hong Kong?
Well, we only knew they were common, of course, after the war, when we heard that so-and-so, who we thought was a hairdresser, was a Japanese officer or a Japanese interpreter. Or so-and-so, we thought was a Chinese magician, was in fact working either for the Japanese, or he was in fact a Japanese. That, of course, is what made the European, it's so difficult for a European to escape from China, was the fact that no way can a European look like an Oriental and he'd be picked up like a sort of sore thumb. I think the battalion was really unfit. The best battalion, of course, was the English battalion, the Middlesex Regiment. They had a first-class commanding officer. Their training was very high, very hard, much harder than ours was, I feel. Even before being a benefit of hindsight, the Middlesex Regiment training always seemed of a harder and perhaps higher standard than ours. They, of course, didn't come from India like we did. I don't think they'd served as broad and got the mental unapproach to the war that we probably had in the Scots.
So, on the Sunday, you were playing tennis, and then you were called.
We were all told to rejoin our units. And I, of course, went up to the frontier. And I was not right on the frontier personally. I was at battalion headquarters. And my job was then to, on my recall from the tennis courts, my job was to unload Chinese Bren guns and make them serviceable for firing, because they were all covered in grease. I had to clean all these guns off and get the necessary ammunition and fire these guns for practice to get them working. What actually happened to the guns, I don't know. They just disappeared. I personally never used a Chinese machine gun during what little fighting I did. But I remained at battalion headquarters. Our only air defence, of course, was Bren guns on a tripod, as far as battalion headquarters were concerned. We had a company up forward in the right up at the front. But that more or less finishes up to the end of the Sunday before war broke out. Battalion headquarters was the site of a rifle range. Actually, it was a place where I had visited quite often for skeet and clay pigeon shooting. It was a hard pad cut into the side of the main road that ran to the border, known as Castle Peak Road, and we were in bivouacs. On the Sunday, I'd had a very busy day. I was, as we've already established, I was the band pianist, and I used to have the piano on a 1,500-weight truck. And while my battalion was under canvas, on the Sundays, the padre used to meet up with me at battalion headquarters. He had his truck and a driver, and I had a 1,500-weight truck. With a driver on which was the piano, and we used to visit the various platoons and companies that were under canvas on the mainland, and used to give them about half an hour's service. Then that was wrapped up, sing a couple of hymns, and then we'd be on our way to the next platoon or company that was stationed. I'd perhaps do half a dozen short services on the course of the Sunday mornings that the battalion was under canvas. And the pattern was exactly the same on this particular Sunday morning. We did the half a dozen services, and then the paddy said, right, that's it. So I immediately changed my clothes into civilian gear, shorts and white shorts and shirt, and crossed over onto the island, Hong Kong, and went down to the Civil Service Club, which is in Happy Valley, and met my friend who worked in the local government, or I suppose you could call it the Hong Kong government, and two Russians who were also employed in government work, members of the Civil Service, and we were playing tennis for what was left of the morning and into the afternoon, thoroughly enjoying ourselves as we usually did, and two military policemen suddenly appeared, walked over to us, and we stopped playing. They said, any of you gentlemen members of the armed forces? If so, you're to report to your units immediately. It appears that there is the likelihood of some disturbance way up on the border, and there must be no delay at all. You must go straight back if you're a member of the forces or in any way connected with security arrangements. Well, my particular pal and I went and had my last meal in Hong Kong. It was at a dairy farm, and it was the only place in Hong Kong at that time that had been air-conditioned. Air conditioning was not the thing it is today. But the dairy farm was the one place where you could really eat in the cool. And I remember the meal very well. I finished up with waffles, which was a great favourite of mine. In fact, when we go abroad now, I always look to see if there's waffles and always sample them to see if they ever tasted like those particular waffles did in Hong Kong that day. But they didn't. However, I had my waffles, went back to the unit in Castle Peak Road where I was stationed at the battalion headquarters. As I said before, got on with the Bren guns, cleaned those up, and then settled down for the night in my bivouac. About 7 o'clock in the morning, traffic light crashing, we could see some planes go over, and we realised that war had broken out, or that the Japanese were attacking the Kai Tak airport. There's no resistance to them that I can remember. We did have some Hong Kong and Shanghai Defence Corps people, I think, manned the artillery, anti-aircraft artillery in Hong Kong, but I don't remember them doing very much. The planes continued to come over several times during the day. We had our Bren guns for anti-aircraft purposes, but we never had occasion to use them. Night fell rather uneasily, and about 2 o'clock in the morning, I was woken up and said that I was wanted by the adjutant and the commanding officer. So I went down to their bivouac, or their little headquarters, and they said that they wanted me to take a section of two men 6 miles in front of our forward lines to try and make contact with the enemy, that the corporal that they had earmarked for them for the job had fallen down and was unable to carry it out owing to a bad attack of nerves, and I was felt my lot to take over. So we had a very good meal about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I remember it very well, just as well as I do the waffles. It was steak, onions and tomatoes, something that we rarely had, only something right out of the ordinary. And we hurriedly got this down, and a truck arrived, a 1,500-weight truck, and the two people, both bandsmen, were with me, and we got onto our truck. And can you... if you remember, I said that when General Maltby took over, the Royal Scots were pushed up onto the frontier under Cavus, and we were taking over pillboxes in an area which we were not very familiar. Well, just in front of the battalion headquarters, there was the Shing Mun Redoubt, which was on the left-hand side, looking towards the border, of Gin Drinker's Line. Gin Drinker's Line was 11, consisted of 11 pillboxes, rather staggered. That's the reason it was called Gin Drinkers, I suppose, because of the staggering of the pillboxes. And I was to go in front of those 6 miles up towards the Hong Kong Brewery along the Castle Peak Road. I was to go up into the hills on the right-hand side where there were slip trenches dug. In these trenches, in this particular trench, from which we had a very good view, almost up to the border, were stored some .303 ammunition and some .45 ammunition. The .45 ammunition was for my Tommy gun. We'd recently been issued with Thompson submachine guns, and which was loaded with drums, containing, I think, about 40, 45 rounds of ammunition. One of my men was armed with a sniper's rifle, .303, and the other one had a Bren gun, .303. And the idea was that we should endeavour to contact the enemy, or if they contacted us, we would hold them up for as long as possible, then withdraw about a quarter of a mile to another slit trench and hold them up until dusk. We were to remain there until dusk and then make our own way back, if possible, along the Castle Peak Road and rejoin battalion headquarters. That was my orders. Well, we had our very enjoyable meal, and pitch dark, no mines laid, and we hopped onto our 1,500 weight trucks, and we went approximately 6 miles up in front of the battalion headquarters, which made us the very forward troops. There were police at one time stationed right up on the border, but during the course of the Monday, we had the job of examining them on their way back. So I knew that myself and our two men, we were in the very front. There was nobody between us and the enemy. Well, the truck stopped, we got off, and he just spun round, and away he went. I shall never forget the feeling of just seeing that little red light disappearing in the distance. No more ado, we cleared off the side of the road, up into the hills, and we found our slit trench. And there we remained for the day. Now, on my wrist, I'd got a Lord Elgin watch. It was quite an expensive watch for those days, an American watch. It was gold, or gold-plated, and I was very proud of this. It never let me down. Well, we got to the slit trench, and dawn broke, and we ranged our guns as we tried them out. There was nobody that we could see, so we took a point, saw that our guns were working, all okay, and we just settled down to just remain for the rest of the day to see what was happening. Well, time went on. Looked at my watch, and it stopped. First time in the history that I had the watch. And none of the soldiers with me had the time on them at all. So, as the day wore on, nothing obtained. I said, well, I think by the time we get back, it'll be dark. Let's withdraw. Saw nothing from where we were, so we withdrew to the next trench, found the ammunition. No signs of any. We waited, I suppose, approximately another half an hour, three quarters. No signs of anybody. So we got on the footpath and wound our way down towards Castle Peak Road. We turned a corner, and just on the corner of the roadway was a grass verge which we had to pass. It was on our side of the road. And in the grass verge, we could see, I suppose, about a dozen strangely dressed men. Now, I'd never seen a Japanese soldier, and I'd never seen a Chinese soldier, but we knew that the Chinese, or we thought the Chinese armies, weren't very far away from Hong Kong. We'd been led to believe that if there'd been any attack, Chinese armies. Well, I had to make up my mind quickly whether they were Chinese or Japanese. So